ETF Prime is hosted by investment advisors of the ETF Store. This program is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. Investing in ETFs involves risk, including potential loss of principal. Any past performance figures discussed are not necessarily indicative of future results. The ETF Store is not affiliated with ETF.com or any of its affiliates. ETF.com's participation in this program should not be construed as an endorsement or an indication by ETF.com of the value of any ETF Store product or service. Visit ETFstore.com for more information.
Now it's time for ETF Prime, where we discuss everything you need to know about exchange-traded funds and the world of investing. Whether you're an investing expert or just starting out, Nate will help you get up to date with what's happening on Wall Street and show you how exchange-traded funds can help lower your investment costs, reduce your tax bill, and allow you to take advantage of investment opportunities around the world. And now, the host of ETF Prime, Nate Geraci.
All right, on the show this week, I'm really excited about this. I'll be joined by Stephanie Pierce, who is CEO of ETF Index and Cash Investment Strategies at BNY Mellon Investment Management. Earlier this year, they launched an initial lineup of 8 ETFs. And around the time that happened, Stephanie made a comment to Investment News that certainly caught my attention. She said, quote, "With the increasing concern about concentration risk in the industry, we believe we can give clients an institutional quality choice." In other words, I read that as BNY not being afraid to go right after iShares and Vanguard and State Street. And obviously, those fund companies have an enormous head start, right? We're talking a monumental task to even think about catching them. But if there is a company that just might be able to do it, it could be BNY Mellon. They have a long-established history in the ETF space. Now, that's been on the back end with custody and those sorts of things, but I'm really interested to hear how they're approaching the front end and why they do think they can compete here. And I should note, two of the ETFs they launched have a zero-cost, zero-expense ratio, so we'll definitely discuss that as well. Also later, I'll be joined by John Thompson, co-founder and president at Vesper Capital Management. They offer the Vesper U.S. Large Cap Short-Term Reversal Strategy ETF, ticker symbol U-Turn, U-T-R-N, great ticker. This basically looks to buy the dip in certain S&P 500 stocks every week. And so far, the strategy is working. It's outperformed the S&P 500 since inception, back in 2018. I'll have John explain how this works. And something I find interesting here is there's a real behavioral component as to why this strategy can work to begin with. And of course, I always love talking investor behavior, so we'll definitely get into that as well. Now, to start this week, I have ETF.com Cynthia Murphy on the line with me. We're going to discuss actively managed ETFs. I do feel like this topic is getting a lot more attention this year. And I know we say every year, this will be the year for active ETFs, right? That their time has finally arrived. But it really does seem like active ETFs are gaining some meaningful traction, though performance is still a bit of a question mark, which we'll get into. But let's start this week with ETF.com, Cynthia Murphy.
Time now for our weekly chat with the experts at ETF.com, the world's leading independent authority on ETFs.
In smart beta, Vanguard and iShares still dominate. Single factor ETFs have been successful. If they really get strong track records, I think you might get people motivated to actually sit down and figure out what goes into these funds.
Cynthia, great having you back on the podcast. I'm going to try my best to avoid a massive debate like we had last time you were on here. What was that on ETF labeling?
Yeah, we got going on that one.
Well, Cynthia, let's start with some research you recently compiled on active equity ETF performance. And there's a lot more to the active ETF story. I just thought we'd start with performance because I do think it gets to the bigger picture of what might work here and ultimately whether active ETFs can be successful. So I'll just open this up to you and then we can go from there. Give us some highlights from this research. What did you find?
We decided to look into active ETFs because, as you said, you know, this is the year where everybody's looking for them to deliver. You know, is this the year of active management? And, you know, there's a lot of people who say for active to really shine, you have to have a market that's a little bit in chaos, because if everything is moving in unison, there's not a lot of opportunity to go find alpha. Well, we haven't seen chaos like we have in 2020, so perfect time for them to shine. And what we found is that most active ETFs actually did not outperform just plain vanilla benchmarks. In fact, I would say a quarter or to a fifth of active ETFs in each segment managed to outperform benchmarks, which means there's a whole bunch of them that continue to underperform just a, you know, your classic beta, low-cost portfolios. So it has been an interesting year because active managers did not shine, as you would expect, as a group, even though in theory they would have had this opportunity to do so this year. What we also found is that the ones that it's important to actually, before we get into that, is that when you look at active ETFs, you know, there is a difference between a rule-based active versus a discretionary active. And what we saw is that a lot of the outperformance was in the so-called rules-based active. So funds that actually are built around an index, and then they'll have an active component, say an options overlay or, you know, some kind of defensive positioning that comes in and out at the discretion of the manager, not your true go-anywhere, whatever the manager thinks that morning kind of portfolio. Those actually, a lot of those continue to underperform. So it's just been like a really interesting to see the segmentation in active and what has worked and hasn't worked this year.
You know, when you go through that, if you think about active management as a whole, we know that it's been challenged, right? And if you look historically, what is it, roughly 80% of active funds underperform their benchmark over longer periods of time. Should we expect anything different in the active ETF space?
Honestly, if you look at any SPIVA report that will tell you exactly that year after year, I mean, how many years have we been looking at this, Nate? It's the story is the same every year. What changes is that, you know, 20% of outperformance is a different group of managers every year. So even if you find outperformance, there is no persistence of outperformance. And I don't see a reason for that to change. What's interesting this year is that there actually has been investor demand for it. If you think about the number of active ETFs in the market that is right now, there's almost 400 ETFs, which means that's about, 17% of all ETFs in the market today are actively managed. But in terms of assets, they only represent less than 3% of the total ETF market assets. Well, in 2020, so far, active ETFs have attracted 10% of that asset inflow. So it's a pickup from their average, demand. And in terms of launches, 50% of ETF launches this year are actively managed. I mean, that's a huge, change in the tide. So the outperformance hasn't been there consistently, but there has been a change in the demand, or at least in the attention investors are giving these things, and the number of funds coming to market this year that are active. So maybe something will change. Maybe the stuff coming to market now will be better.
Well, you bring up a good point, because I keep saying that the success of active ETFs will ultimately come down to performance. However, going back to active mutual funds, we know their performance hasn't been great either, right? And what's interesting is, despite the fact there's been this huge shift from active to passive over the past decade or so, active mutual funds still hold an enormous chunk of assets. And so what I'm getting at is, even if the performance of active ETFs hasn't been great, do you think the lower costs and the tax efficiency of ETFs, and we now have non-transparent ETFs that can protect active managers' quote-unquote secret sauce, is all of that enough to get investors to move to the ETF structure, even if the performance isn't necessarily great, right? Because we know investors are still in active mutual funds.
Yeah, I absolutely think so. And in fact, if you look at flows in the last 5, 6, 7 years, active mutual funds have been losing assets consistently to ETFs. I think if you are an active investor at heart and really believe in active management, you're going to continue to want to bet in that wrapper, whichever it is that gives you that access to active management. I think, on some level, it's, what's your investment philosophy, the type of investor you are. And if you're in an active mutual fund, chances are you're going to want to go to an active ETF as opposed to a passive ETF. You're going to hold true to that. I think the active mutual funds continue to hold on to those assets, for a few reasons. One is, if you've held an active mutual fund before the last decade, you probably have a ton of gains in there. So to get out of that position, you're going to face a big capital gains hit. You also have, you know, the issue of dollar cost averaging, which is really popular in the mutual fund space. You can't really do that yet with ETFs, in a lot of retirement accounts, things like that. But I think the demand is there, and I think the number of these non-transparent active ETFs coming to market this year, there's about 7 or 8 now, signals that that's coming. And, you know, I had Elizabeth Cashner, I talked to her yesterday, FX, that pulled some data on the non-transparent active. It's still kind of hard to tell because some of these funds have only been in the market, what, 2-3 weeks, and they haven't really disclosed holdings yet because they have that, you know, quarterly disclosure at best. But for the most part, you know, looking at just some general benchmarks, they're all outperforming vanilla benchmarks from ClearBridge, American Century, some of the Fidelity, except the Fidelity Value one. So the non-transparent active so far, it's really too early to tell, but they seem to be delivering on their premise. So it could just be a matter of time, but we start to see some conversion from the mutual fund holders into this space.
Well, and one thing I think we can say with pretty good certainty about active management and the ETF wrapper, look, they're not some sort of magic performance enhancer, right? They're not going to turn some mediocre manager into a star. However, we do know ETFs tend to be lower cost, so there's a lower hurdle that the active manager is going to have to jump over to generate alpha. And ETFs do tend to be more tax efficient, which is obviously going to help after-tax performance. So, you know, I think those two things are favorable. Now, at the end of the day, the active manager still has to select the right holdings to outperform. It's ultimately going to come down to that. And I guess on that note, Cynthia, I want to talk a little bit about ARK Invest, because I think if you look at the active ETF space, there's probably been no better example of success. From your perspective, why is that? Like what is the blueprint here that ARK is following?
You know, the team Cathie Wood put together just does not cease to amaze anybody in this industry, for sure. It's not like their products are particularly cheap. I think they're about 75 basis points a year, which is above the average for actively managed ETFs in the market today, which sits at 69 basis points in terms of cost. But I think what ARK did so well, actually, was differentiate itself. So they're focused hardcore on these 5 disruptive innovation areas, you know, your genome sequencing, automation, next generation internet, blockchain, all that kind of stuff. But I think from the get-go, when Cathie launched this firm, she talked about the saturation of the Me Too Index products, and there's really not a lot of differentiation, and she just honed in on that. And we could argue that maybe that doesn't make sense because we see most asset flows every year to your cheapest, vanilla-ist of the funds, right? But I think ARK really did well with part of its own niche and kept it going. But you have to remember, I mean, now we look at it as like this massive success, but, you know, when their first ETFs came to market in 2014, they sat there for at least a couple of years with $20 million in assets going nowhere. They were barely, you know, seed money.
Yeah, good point.
Happening. So it took like, it wasn't until they hit that 3-year live record, 2017, and have that strong performance for 3 years. And it coincided with the time when Bitcoin took off and they were the only ETFs to offer any access to Bitcoin. So it was the perfect storm in 2017 for the funds to really begin to take off. So by then they had been in the market for 3 years already. And so I think it was active management that, one, was full of conviction. So even when it was hard at the beginning, the firm stayed true to what they set out to do. They held on to what a lot of times were contrarian bets. Nobody was investing in Tesla and way before, you know, Cathie had it on for funds. So, and I think she also, you know, they lowered their fees. When they first came to market, they were almost 1% in fees. It was 95 basis points. And over time, they lower that to be more competitive. So I think it's a great example of reading your audience. You know, they were looking for disruption, looking for differentiation, looking for full conviction that is backed up by a lot of research. And I think it's active management that's really designed to be long-term. I mean, Cathie would be the first person to tell you that when they go evaluate a company to put in a portfolio, they're not looking at, is this a hot performer this year? The question is, where is this company going to be 5 years from now? So it really is active management that is meant to deliver over time, not in the short-term windows. And I think that has resonated. And, you know, the RKK now has a $6.5 billion fund, is the biggest actively managed equity ETF in the market by a long, long shot. And we can't stop being amazed at the performance. They're up 75% this year, the five ARK ETFs.
It is amazing. I mean, ARK is now managing, what, over $10 billion in assets overall. I was looking, I mean, they're showing up in the top 10 flows of all ETF issuers, which is remarkable for a boutique firm like this. But Cynthia, as you went through that, I completely agree. I mean, if I were to boil down the key way to be successful in the active ETF space, it was everything that you just said. I think high conviction, I think differentiation. You have to do something different than the plain vanilla benchmarks. Nobody wants an expensive closet index fund right now. I think on that note, there have to be fair fees. And while ARK is charging, what, an average, what would you say, 70 basis points, somewhere around there, that's still much cheaper than a lot of the active mutual funds that are out there, at least on an average basis. And then ultimately, performance is going to be important. So I don't know that, we were talking about earlier, performance is necessarily going to be everything in driving assets to active ETFs, but obviously that's a factor here in terms of success. Looking to the future of active ETFs, obviously, as we talked about, we do have the quote-unquote non-transparent ETFs rolling out, and more firms in general are rolling out active ETFs, whether transparent or non-transparent. As a matter of fact, a couple of weeks ago, your colleague Laura Krieger and I, we discussed how there have been just as many active ETFs launched this year as passive ETFs, which I think may surprise some people. But overall, how do you view the future of active ETFs? What do you expect to happen here?
Well, based on what we're seeing this year, I would think a lot of the potential for active ETF demand, if you're going to go just launch, you know, a large cap equity active ETF without anything in particular, it has to be a bring your own assets type of effort. So you're just going to convert your own mutual fund clients into this wrapper and call it a day. If you actually want to get out there in the market and, you know, find organic growth from outside demand, what has really worked in active management is just this whole concept of the, you know, kind of defined outcome strategy. So there's been a lot of innovation in the downside risk management type of ETF, that whole, you know, own the Russell 2000 or 1000 or 3000 and have some kind of downside risk management active sleeve in there. I think there's a lot of potential for that. The demand for that kind of wrapper has been phenomenal. And it's, you know, no, it's pseudo active, if you will, because you're basically still tracking an index in the equity part and you're just playing around with your defensive mechanism in there. But I think there's a lot of potential in there. Disruptive tech is going to continue to be a really exciting space because I think technology more and more is no longer its own standalone sector. It's the sector in every other sector. So those kinds of companies that are, a lot of them are startups, a lot of them, you know, fail to meet a lot of index screens. There's a lot of opportunity there, and I think we're going to continue to see people trying to slice and dice the what's next type of space through an active sleeve. And you could find traction. I mean, that's Cathie Wood's entire business has been that. But it's going to be a tough road because, you know, when you're costing on average 35% more than any passive ETFs out there, it's you have a lot to prove to justify why you're going to charge more if you're not going to deliver at least that much more in performance. So as much as we know, don't buy an ETF for performance, you should buy for a goal for how it fits in your diversified exposure. When it comes to paying more for an active manager, you cannot escape the importance of performance, and that's going to be key.
Well, Cynthia, I think the perfect note to end on. Excellent stuff this week. Always enjoy having you on the podcast. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
That was ETF.com, Cynthia Murphy. Yeah. My next guest is Stephanie Pierce, CEO of ETF Index and Cash Investment Strategies at BNY Mellon Investment Management, who earlier this year, they launched their initial suite of ETFs. There are 8 ETFs in all, including the first truly free stock and bond ETF, zero expense ratios. And Stephanie is now on the line with me from Boston. Stephanie, it's a pleasure. Thank you for joining me.
Nate, thanks so much for having me. Great to be here.
Well, let's start with the decision to enter the ETF market. I think most who follow the industry know that BNY Mellon has a long, prominent history in the ETF space. I've always thought of BNY, especially on the custodial side, but the bottom line is BNY is involved in many aspects of ETFs, and you've now made this decision to launch your own branded products. What was the catalyst here? Why now?
Nate, as a leading global asset manager, our goal is to deepen and broaden our client relationships by meeting their evolving needs. As you know, ETFs represent over $4 trillion in assets in the U.S. and over $5 trillion globally. And at the current growth rate, ETFs are set to outpace mutual funds in just 3 years. Put simply, we are seeing ETFs as the rapidly becoming the investment vehicle of choice for many of our clients. Our clients are voting with their feet. And by launching ETFs, we're making our leading institutional quality investment capabilities available to a broader range of clients through an ETF structure. Now, from an enterprise perspective, as you mentioned, BNY Mellon is a leader across the ETF ecosystem, from fund administration to custody and clearing to capital markets, securities lending, and even ETF sub-advisory. Launching BNY Mellon sponsored ETFs completes what we see as the end-to-end ETF value chain of products and services across our firm that enables us to provide clients with what we think of as a one-stop shopping experience for all their ETF needs.
We're going to talk about the ETF lineup itself in just a moment, but if I were to paint with a broad brush, the 8 ETFs you offer are really core building blocks in a portfolio, right? Low-cost beta. And as I know you're well aware, that's an extremely competitive part of the ETF market. It's tough, and I think success here is clearly predicated on building scale and competing on price with the largest players out there. Now, obviously, you expect to be successful, or else you wouldn't have launched these, but why is that? Why do you think you can compete in this space?
Nate, while our BNY Mellon sponsored ETFs are new to the market, as you mentioned, BNY Mellon has been an ETF leader across our businesses for many years. And with our deep and broad ETF experience and our scale and efficiency across the ETF ecosystem, we're offering our clients an institutional quality choice with a brand they trust at an exceptional value. And we believe that combination does distinguish us from both new and established ETF issuers. Now, I would also emphasize that our measure of success isn't necessarily about just competing with the more established players in the space. Success to us is all about offering our clients a full suite of solutions for their investing needs. As clients choose to work with fewer and more trusted financial partners, we want to be their partner of choice. Now, I can't respond without answering your question about why we chose to launch with these particular products, since you referenced how competitive it is. Our suite of 8 index ETFs, and I know we're going to get to this in more detail, covers the core building blocks in client portfolios and represents close to 60% of all ETF assets by category. So we believe this is a logical place to start. And as you referenced, for the first time in the industry, we are offering zero-fee ETFs in the largest U.S. equity and U.S. fixed income categories in the U.S. ETF marketplace with no waivers, no limitations, and no restrictions, available to all investors, regardless of asset size, holding period, or the nature of their relationship with BNY Mellon.
Okay, so I have to ask you on that point. I know some investors may look at those zero-fee stock and bond ETFs and say, well, wait a minute, if I'm getting something for free, then I'm the product, right? So I'll just ask you, how is it you can offer an ETF for free? Because I do see this question come up quite a bit.
Sure. With our BNY Mellon U.S. Large Cap Core Equity and U.S. Core Bond ETFs, we are offering clients access to the two largest U.S. equity and fixed income ETF categories in the marketplace for free, as I mentioned, with no restrictions or limitations. And we believe those savings can help them better meet their investment goals. Now, what we mean by no restrictions is that these ETFs are available to all investors, regardless of size, holding period, or the relationship they have with our firm. And we're doing this for our clients. You know, the short answer, Nate, is that our leadership across the entire ETF ecosystem makes our firm uniquely suited to do this. The scale and breadth of ETF services across the BNY Mellon enterprise enables us to deliver exceptional value for our clients in a way that few other large institutional quality asset managers can do.
Yeah, and I want to talk more about that, specifically distribution. So a couple of weeks ago, there was a fantastic piece in Barron's with the head of RIA custody at your Pershing unit, Ben Harrison. And as I read through that, it was very clear to me that your ETFs do have the ability to find a wide audience through the Pershing platform. Can you talk about that and perhaps the importance of distribution as a whole in the ETF space?
Absolutely. Well, the short answer is distribution is critical, and we do have, as you said, some unique ways to do that. First and foremost, let me mention that our ETF range is available to individual investors and financial advisors, really all buyers, with no transaction fees through all the leading online brokerage platforms in the industry. But specifically on BNY Mellon's Pershing platform, we are offering what we call exclusive access, and that is Ben Harrison's term, for clients who use Pershing's new subscription-based pricing model, whereby assets held in BNY Mellon ETFs can be excluded from the subscription fee calculation. And that's a terrific value proposition for those who choose to use our ETFs for their core passive exposure. So simply put, subscription-based Pershing clients who use BNY Mellon ETFs pay no management fees, no transaction fees, and no custody fees for the two largest U.S. equity and U.S. fixed income allocations in many of their client portfolios. And those savings can really enhance investment returns and enable clients to better meet their investment goals. Now, while we're talking about distribution, I should mention as well that from an institutional distribution perspective, our index business, that is managing these funds, is the fifth largest in the U.S., is buy-rated by all major institutional consultants, and is also the leading ETF sub-advisor in the industry, all of which makes it easy for our client-facing professionals across the BNY Mellon organization to integrate our ETFs into their ongoing client conversations. And we've been very pleased by the high level of interest from a reverse inquiry perspective from the institutional community of professional buyers that the firm serves across all of our businesses.
Stephanie, going back to something that you were alluding to earlier, sort of BNY's deep integration and broad experience in the ETF industry, and certainly the many relationships you've built with other ETF issuers on the back end, handling things like custody, I'm curious, is there any concern that those issuers will now view BNY as a competitor because you've launched ETFs? And so, I don't know, that could perhaps disrupt these other aspects of BNY's business, custody and administration and those sorts of things?
Nate, our BNY Mellon sponsored ETFs are part of a very broad suite of ETF businesses across our enterprise. And as an ETF issuer, we work with our ETF service providers at the firm in the same way that any other ETF issuer would do. We're well served by the institutional quality expertise and service that BNY Mellon is known for amongst all of our clients. And we're just one of many satisfied clients of the firm. So the short answer is we don't believe so.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the ETF lineup itself. And if you don't mind, let me first run through the eight ETFs. So there's the BNY Mellon Large Cap Core Equity ETF, ticker BKLC. Again, that has a zero expense ratio. It's free. There are no waivers or other restrictions here. It truly has a zero fee. There's the BNY US Mid Cap Core Equity ETF, ticker BKMC. And then there's a small cap version, BKSE. There are two international stock ETFs, a developed international version, ticker BKIE, and an emerging markets version, BKEM. And then there are three bond ETFs. So a core bond ETF, BKAG, that's also free, zero expense ratio. And then there's a short-term corporate bond ETF and a high-yield bond ETF, tickers BKSB and BKHY. Now, as we discussed earlier, it's clear you're covering the major asset classes here, right? And you're doing so at a very low price point. What else would you highlight about this initial suite?
So one of the areas that has gotten the most focus, in addition to the two zero-fee ETFs that you mentioned, is that we're making our leading high-yield beta strategy available through an ETF structure for the first time, which is a well-known strategy in the institutional community we serve. Now, investing in high-yield for those that are not aware of it, is traditionally challenging. Transaction costs tend to be quite high. And as a result, many of the other high-yield ETFs out there struggle to actually deliver the return of the broad high-yield index. Perhaps because of this, the leading high-yield ETFs that we see in the marketplace tend to use more liquid benchmark, which essentially forfeit what we think of as the illiquidity premium that makes high-yield investing so attractive. Historically, investing in this narrower and more liquid high-yield index has meant a potential performance drag of anywhere from 30 to 50 basis points per year relative to what the broad high-yield index has delivered. If you compound that over time, that performance gap can be quite significant. So the BNY Mellon High Yield Beta ETF is designed to provide a beta solution that reflects the full credit spectrum of broad U.S. high yield and seeks to overcome some of those challenges in the high yield marketplace. We use our deep experience as index managers to build a broad, liquid, and cost-effective solution that's also systematic and risk-controlled. And we do use a proprietary credit model that utilizes quality, momentum, and value factors and really seeks to enhance security selection and reduce downside exposure. So that credit model assists our portfolio managers in the sampling process to help screen out and avoid overweighting corporate bonds that either have weaker financials or a higher probability of either default or downgrade. So again, we've been very pleased with the reception so far and the flows into the product, and this is one of what we feel is one of the more unique attributes of the suite.
One of the things I was curious about, if you look at the other bond ETFs, they're all using Bloomberg Barclays benchmarks, and then the equity ETFs are all using Morningstar benchmarks, if I remember correctly. Can you offer any insight into that? Like, did you consider self-index? Or how did you land on these index providers?
Sure. So with respect to our benchmarks, we're very pleased to have chosen Bloomberg for fixed income and Morningstar for equity, as you mentioned. We carefully selected our benchmark providers to bring both significant experience building and delivering quality benchmarks, as well as substantial marketplace recognition. So I think it's well known that Bloomberg is the leading and most recognizable fixed income benchmark provider in the industry. And in fact, we use Bloomberg for the majority of our institutional fixed income index exposures as well. Morningstar is a little bit newer to the space, and their equity indices provide very similar exposure to the major broad-based equity benchmarks and are much more cost-effective. And that enables us to provide greater value to our clients. Morningstar is also a strategic partner with a strong brand, a very high-quality organization that's great to work with. And most importantly for us, they are deeply committed to the index business.
Any thoughts on the self-indexing? I know that's clearly a way to chop back-end costs and therefore be able to offer the ETF products at a lower price point. Is that something that you considered?
The short answer is no, and the reason is that we feel we are best focused on our core competencies and to outsource or source elsewhere the core competencies of others, namely indexing. So that was why we chose the path we did.
Okay, so moving forward, what should investors expect from BNY just in terms of building out the ETF product suite?
Sure. Our ETF strategy remains very focused on making our leading institutional quality investment capabilities available to a broader range of clients in an ETF structure. The next phase will likely include actively managed strategies and, like the index suite, will capitalize on some unique elements of our firm to deliver innovative solutions to our clients. In addition to that, we look forward to introducing BNY Mellon ETF model portfolios, which is one of the key drivers of the rapid acceleration in ETF usage by advisors, as you know. These portfolios will show clients how to use our ETFs within a diversified portfolio to deliver a specific investment outcome, such as income, capital preservation, or growth. So those are two key areas of our roadmap going forward.
Well, Stephanie, it was an absolute pleasure connecting this week. Congratulations on the success so far. I checked yesterday. In just a few months, I'm showing already close to $300 million in assets with this lineup. Off to a great start. Certainly wish you the best moving forward. Thank you.
Nate, thanks so much for having me. Great to be here.
That was Stephanie Pierce, CEO of ETF Index and Cash Investment Strategies at BNY Mellon Investment Management. I'm now joined by John Thompson, co-founder and president at Vesper Capital Management. They're behind the Vesper U.S. Large Cap Short-Term Reversal Strategy ETF. This has one of the better ticker symbols you'll find, U-TURN, U-T-R-N, which I love. And this ETF has outperformed the S&P 500 since its inception back in September 2018. John is now on the line with me from Philadelphia. John, appreciate the time. Thank you for joining me.
Nate, really a pleasure to be here. Thanks for the opportunity.
So I call U-TURN the buy the dip ETF because that's essentially what it's doing every single week. But I'm going to let you take us through the investment process here, and then we can get into some of the other aspects of this ETF and strategy. Do you want to explain how this works?
Oh, absolutely, Nate. Absolutely. It's a fresh, unique trading strategy that's been utilized inside of hedge funds and bank trading departments for years. And it's really the first time a strategy like this has been brought to Main Street, specifically in the form of an ETF. And, you know, what drove us to put this together was that the whole strategy is based on a concept, an anomaly called short-term reversal. And anyone who's ever bought or sold a stock is, whether you're familiar with the term or not, will know what I'm talking about. Every single day, information hits the markets, and lots of times investors overreact. Stocks plummet more than they actually should, but once the information is digested and the reality kicks in that there's been an overreaction, to those relatively healthy stocks, there's a big rebound. And this short-term reversal strategy has been researched and written about for the better part of the last 50 years, and is SeekingAlpha.com's Curtis Hemily, you know, says it's probably one of the most powerful anomalies that he's ever tested. And that follows through with Dr. Victor Chow, who's the creator of this particular strategy. Dr. Chow worked over 30 years in looking to come up with a strategy that basically could protect on the downside, participate on the upside, and outperform the major market indexes over the investment cycles. And with this, the one aspect of the market that he could not take his eye off through all of this was this concept of short-term reversal. So his idea was that stocks that are down in value over a short period of time, down in value in a low volatility manner, without a lot of price movement on the way down, have more of a propensity to rebound than stocks that are down in value with high volatility. So he developed what we now know as the Chow ratio, kind of similar to the Sharpe ratio, in that it's a measure of return over volatility. And he applies this ratio to every single stock inside the S&P 500 on a weekly basis. And those stocks with the lowest Chow ratio value, the 25 stocks with the lowest Chow ratio value, are the ones that ultimately end up in our portfolio and the ones that have the best opportunity to potentially experience a reversal in the coming five trading days. You know, it's a rules-based, systematic approach. And when I first looked at the returns on an Excel spreadsheet, I was kind of blown away. And, you know, before we developed the ETF, I felt that the whole concept needed more credibility. So we actually partnered with Standard & Poor's and dumped the data on them, and they recalculated all of Dr. Chow's work. And going back to 2006, their calculations actually were slightly better than what the professors were. And, you know, those calculations were showing that this strategy from 2006 through 2018 had consistently outperformed on an annual basis. And then if you carry it through to today with the U-Turn X index, which this U-Turn ETF is based off of, the strategy has outperformed 13 out of the last 15 years. So it's really something unique. It's something that, you know, it jumped out at me when I looked at its performance, its would-be performance, mind you, you know, how it reacted during the financial crisis in 2008 and 2009. I think in 2008, when the S&P 500 was down 37%, this strategy was only down like 21-22%. And so, you know, we launched this, the actual ETF, in September of 2018, right at the top of the market, if you remember. In the fourth quarter of 18, the market had started heading straight down. And our first reaction was, oh, my gosh, what did we do? But knowing that this strategy, you know, was designed to at least protect in some way, shape, or form in the downturns, you know, we just had to let it go and see how it did. And out of the gate, it went down with the S&P 500. But then in December, when volatility really picked up and the market dropped almost another 10%, this is when this strategy really kicked into gear and started to outperform. Not only outperformed in a big way in December of 18, but then followed through with all the volatility that we saw in the first quarter last year, 2019. In addition to that, obviously, the set of circumstances that we've seen earlier this year, you know, with the pandemic and all the market uncertainty, economic uncertainty, the strategy has performed similarly to the way it did during the financial crisis, you know, back in 2008, 2009, when initially the strategy, you know, went down with the market, maybe even a little bit more, but on the rebound, with all the volatility, there were an awful lot of short-term reversal situations to take advantage of.
John,
that all makes sense, Nate.
In terms of the anomaly itself, the short-term reversal anomaly, I always find the investor behavior side of the equation to be fascinating. And you talked about this potentially existing because of investors overreacting, which to a certain degree sort of goes against the efficient market hypothesis, right? Can you talk about this a little bit more about why this anomaly can exist?
Yeah. I mean, I've been involved in the markets in various capacities for the past 33 years. And, you know, one of the things that you learn early on is, you know, stock prices are driven by essentially two things, you know, fundamentals, you know, earnings growth and investor sentiment. And, you know, you could do all the fundamental analysis in the world and pick good stocks. And when fundamentals are ruling the day, you're going to have portfolios that are going to outperform. The one thing that's very difficult to gauge is the investor sentiment side. And, you know, this is based on human emotion, based on, you know, the two predominant emotions, which are fear and greed. And as long as there are buyers and sellers in the market, you know, there's going to be, you know, disagreements as to, you know, underlying valuations and situations with, you know, particular securities. There's going to be volatility. And when there's volatility, there's going to be overreaction. And you see a bulk of that overreaction in periods of uncertainty, very similar to what we've seen, you know, so far this year. And this strategy basically, in a systematic way, takes advantage of those overreactions, you know, the which are driven by the human emotions of fear and greed, without a doubt.
Obviously, some stocks go down for very good reasons, right? How does the CTF attempt to increase the odds of success in terms of avoiding stocks where the bad news really is bad news, the stocks that should be going down?
That's a very good question. That when I first started to get to know Dr. Chow, that was my first question. That how do you differentiate between the unhealthy losers and the healthy losers that have a propensity to rebound? And as I mentioned a couple minutes ago, his idea was to differentiate looking at the underlying volatility of each of the individual stocks. So stocks that are declining in value over a week's period of time in a low volatility manner, in his approach, have more of a propensity to rebound than stocks that are down in value in a high volatility manner. And the underlying aspect of this is that if stocks are declining without a lot of daily, you know, hourly price movement, there's probably more confidence with the traders in those stocks than stocks that are gyrating wildly, you know, as they're going down. So, you know, Dr. Chow backtested this, you know, this strategy, you know, going all the way back, like I said, to 2006. And that's the main ingredient. My first reaction was this is kind of going to be kind of like dogs of the Dow. You know, you're going to buy all of last year's losers. But, you know, I personally never liked that strategy because, to your point, Nate, there's a reason why a lot of those stocks fundamentally are losers and they're going to stay losers. So, you know, Dr. Chow looked at the volatility aspect and uses that as a differentiator, you know, in discerning between, you know, the healthy losers and the unhealthy losers. But I might add that, you know, with this trading strategy, on a weekly basis, we're not necessarily looking for good companies, good fundamentally run companies. We're looking for good stocks. And maybe even a couple of examples of that so far this year was back in January. You know, we had GE in the portfolio for a week. And everybody knows the struggles that GE has had over the last few years and putting a new game plan together to improve their earnings. And, you know, leading into their fourth quarter 2019 earnings announcement, there wasn't a lot of hope in regards to, you know, GE starting to get back on track. But as it got closer to earnings, the stock was down in value in a low volatility manner. And, when, you know, it made it into our portfolio. And the week that we held it, the stock appreciably outperformed the S&P. And I think the street was surprised, you know, when management came out with some real fresh ideas. It is a relatively new management team. And in the week that we held it, stock was up to almost 14%. Versus the S&P that week, which was down 1.44%. Another good example with a stock that's even no longer in the S&P was back in April with Harley-Davidson. Again, from a macro perspective, you know, with the COVID-19 pandemic hitting, everybody realized that, you know, there weren't going to be as many, you know, high-end motorcycles being sold in this type of environment. And, you know, the whole industry group, you know, was taken down. In front of earnings, and again, not a lot of hope was given, especially to a company like Harley Davidson. But again, as we got closer to earnings in late April, there began rumblings that the new management at Harley Davidson had really tightened the reins and was increasing their cash positions and could much better weather the storm than I think a lot of analysts had thought. And the week that we held it, right in and around the earnings announcement, stock was up 37%, you know, versus the S&P that week, which was only up 5%. So that's giving you a couple of examples of some really household names of how the strategy works. And then in addition to that, this is an equal-weighted portfolio. We have 25 stocks, 25 S&P 500 stocks, each with 4% weightings. And when you factor in, at the time that we held Harley-Davidson, Harley-Davidson's weighting in the S&P 500 was only like probably 0.2%. So we had 20 times the weighting in Harley-Davidson that week than the S&P 500 did, which is another contributor to, in the long run, the excess return that this strategy has been able to generate.
John, just a couple minutes left. How much of the portfolio turns over each week? And what I'm specifically curious about is the impact of trading costs on the returns of this strategy. Because if you have more turnover, obviously there are costs involved, right? There are some frictions here, bid-ask spreads and so forth. How does that factor into the returns?
Yeah, actually, as I mentioned, short-term reversal and capitalizing on it has been written about, researched, and utilized for the better part of the last 50 years. But one of the reasons this is the first time it's being brought to Main Street is because trading costs have come down so much over the last 15, 20 years. 20 years ago, to implement a strategy where we're turning the portfolio over 80 to 100% a week, trading costs would have eaten into all the excess return and not made this feasible. But now that you can trade for practically pennies a share, trading costs don't eat into the excess return anymore. And as such, the net you know, positive results that have been gained, you know, since specifically the inception of the fund.
Okay, so where does this ETF fit in a portfolio? And I guess along with that, how should an investor expect this ETF to react compared to, I don't know, say a plain vanilla S&P 500 index fund? Obviously, I know the goal here is to outperform, but what does that risk side of the equation look like?
It's pretty interesting. It's really, really interesting in that there's a couple of things going on here. Number one, obviously, the major market indexes, being the S&P 500 or the Russell 1000, they're cap-weighted indexes. And because, you know, the FANG stocks, as we all know, represent, you know, 15 to 20% of those indexes, the more money that goes into these indexes, it becomes kind of a momentum play. And it's really interesting in that, you know, over the first almost 2 years of U-turn, we've been able to outperform the S&P without appreciably owning any of the FANG stocks. You know, so we're actually creating excess return with the other 495 stocks in the index. So we think that, you know, U-turn represents diversification by strategy. And, you know, we all know that at some point, these FANG stocks, investors are going to get to a point where they're going to look at the valuations and say, I think we've bid these up, you know, as far as we can relative to the underlying fundamentals. And when that happens, you know, the S&P 500 or the Russell 1000, it's going to roll over because of the cap heaviness in those stocks. So we like to think that U-turn represents a nice diversification to that, in that, you know, when that occurs, you'll have a hedge, so to speak, that hopefully a strategy that can keep keep the returns coming, you know, even when the broader market isn't doing as well. So you know, we actually like to think of ourselves sometimes as the anti-momentum. In fact, over the course of the almost 2 years that we've been doing this now live, in periods of extreme volatility, that's when you see our strategy perform the best, as was the case in as I mentioned, December 2018 and the first quarter of 2019, or even this year, March and April, when volatility was its greatest. That's when our relative performance was at its best. It's not going to do as well in periods of lower volatility, you know, kind of more melt-up environments, if you may, you know, like we saw late last year, November, December, and into January this year, when the market just kept going up and up and up without a lot of volatility. This is going to struggle to a certain extent to keep pace. But the idea is that there's enough volatility in the market over the long haul to make this strategy viable in the long term. And as I mentioned, when you look at the index that it's based off of, the U-turn X index, this strategy is outperformed 13 out of the last 15 years. And so we really think that diversifying by strategy, adding this as a complement to whatever you're doing, active or passive, in the large cap space, should in the long run add value. And in the environment that we're in, whether you're a retail investor or an institutional investor, I mean, your target rates of return are still in that 6 to 7% range per annum. And when you've got fixed income interest rates, you know, as low as they are currently, without getting a little creative, it's going to be tough to hit those target rates of return that everybody's looking to have. So every basis point of performance counts these days. And I think this is a strategy, especially given the fact that it thrives on volatility and the fact that we're, you know, given the political unrest, the pandemic unrest, the economic unrest, the market unrest, you know, right now, we're in an environment where this strategy has the potential to potentially generate those excess returns that folks are going to need to get to where they want to go.
Well, John, with that, we'll have to leave it there. Great spotlight this week on a really interesting ETF. Certainly wish you continued success. Thank you for joining me.
Nate, I really appreciate the opportunity. Really do. Let's do it again sometime.
Thank you. That was John Thompson, co-founder and president at Vesper Capital Management. That'll do it for this week's ETF Prime. As always, love your feedback. You can find me out on Twitter, at Nate Geraci, or you can send comments through etfprime.com. Next week, an excellent show lined up. I'll be joined by Craig Lazara, who's Managing Director and Global Head of Index Investment Strategy at S&P Dow Jones Indices. So he's going to weigh in on the active versus passive debate. We'll also talk factor investing. And then Granite Shares' Will Rhine is going to talk gold in the Granite Shares Gold Trust. And we'll also highlight one of their other ETFs that's doing pretty well, their XOUT US Large Cap ETF. Until then, have a great week, everyone.